Good morning. You've tuned into the KRFY Morning Show here on 88.5 KRFY Panhandle Community Radio. I am your co-host, Jack Peterson, here in special on a Wednesday with your usual Wednesday morning co-host, the returning Chris Bessler.
Good morning, Jack. How are you?
Good morning, Chris. I'm doing pretty well. Welcome back.
Did you stay up late watching election returns?
I made it till about 12:30, I think, and still did not have really many local results at that time.
Yeah, so. Yeah, they really went late last night. I think I know that the final results came in sometime after 1 a.m. Locally here, even around the state, they came in slowly. Although by 1, we had a pretty good idea who was winning the statewide races, which were most of what was on the ballot.
Yeah. Should we?
Let's jump into the results here locally. I'm sure folks are most interested in that, but because we had only one hot local race, and that was for the Idaho State Senate seat for District 1, of which Bonner and Boundary are both counties, or both make up that district. And in that race, it was the Republican Scott Herndon defeating the independent Steve Johnson. Herndon received 59.12% of the combined vote of the two counties versus Johnson's 40.87%. So to give you the breakdown there, in Bonner County, Herndon received 9,825 votes. Steve Johnson received 7,409 votes. In Boundary County, Scott Herndon received 3,239. In Boundary County, he received 1,620. Steve Johnson received 1,622. So total votes were, Herndon came in with 13,064 votes in the district, and Steve Johnson received 9,031 votes. So it was a write-in campaign. Steve Johnson's name was not on the ballot. He put up a very spirited campaign, I'd say.
I don't think I've seen that many signs for any candidate, Democrat or Republican, at least around Sandpoint.
Or letters to the editor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're coming out pretty strong. But that just goes to the fact that if your name's not on the ballot, it's really tough to win as a write-in. And it also goes to the fact that this is a Republican county. Republicans had a pretty big advantage no matter who was going to be on that ballot.
Here in Bonner County, as you mentioned, you mentioned the totals. I just want to say it was 57% for Herndon and 43% for Steve Johnson, that within a 100th of a percent of that. In Bonner County, closer than in Boundary County,
yes.
Predictably.
Yeah, it was a little closer. This is his home county, so it might be as it might be expected. Mention a couple other things that were on the ballot in the city of Sandpoint. So city residents only voted on this. The tax for tourist lodging passed with 2,098 votes in favor of it. That's 64.77% of the city voters versus 1,141 against it. That comprised 35.23% of the vote. That did require a 60% majority to pass. So it looks like, and we should mention, these are all unofficial results. We're taking these off the Secretary of State's website, but it's not official until the two counties canvass their votes. But these are probably pretty darn accurate, I'm going to say. And there's a whole bunch of stuff to talk about what happened around the state, but let's back up a little bit. Again, for folks who are just tuning in, this is our election show. We're to kind of break down what happened here locally and in Idaho. Who knows what's going to happen nationally, because there's still a lot of races hanging in the balance nationally for control of Congress. But why don't we take a step back and tell everybody what the weather's going to be?
That's an excellent idea. You're right. We are still the morning show here. Here we have a clear, sunny day with a temperature high of only 35 degrees. So all A little chilly still out there. The north wind continues to blow at 5 to 13 miles an hour today with gusts as high as 21. Mostly clear tonight with a low down to 14 degrees. Mostly sunny tomorrow, high of freezing 32 degrees, or thawing, I guess, right on that border. 32 degrees is the high tomorrow and mostly sunny, mostly cloudy on Thursday night, low down to 16. Friday is Veterans Day, it mentions here, and it's partly sunny on Friday with a high of 34 degrees. On Friday night, mostly cloudy, low 19. Saturday, partly sunny, high 36. Low of 18 on Saturday night. So that kind of continuing right in the mid-30s, reaching the high, but most of the time it's going to be freezing outside. And looks like the wind is going to start calming down after today. Today's the kind of breezy gusts as high as 20 miles an hour, 21 miles an hour, but after today, calm wind becoming northeast in the morning.
Yeah, that wind was pretty problematic, and there was some damage around from falling trees. I have a friend whose car was completely destroyed. A big, looked like it was a pine tree, came down on right in the middle of it and just almost took it in half. It was amazing the amount of damage that thing created. A couple other things going on around town. The sunrise this morning was 6:41 a.m., sunset 4:18. Of course, we're now on, we did the fallback on the time, so we're getting an earlier sunset. But this last week, as we get closer to the winter solstice, we've lost 22 minutes of daylight, so the days are getting short.
You may have noticed. I took note of that. You know, Chris, I'm reminded that I think last year there was some big news about the Senate passing by unanimous consent the total repeal of daylight savings time.
Yeah,
but then nothing, as far as I know, has happened in Congress. Is that where it's at?
It got slowed down, but there's still a lot of support for that. Mm-hmm. Either getting rid of daylight savings time or maybe the reverse of that. You know,
I think I'd favor the reverse.
Yeah,
right? Summertime is daylight savings time. That's my preference.
My take on it is I kind of like the whole clock switch in this where we
live. You are about the only person who likes the clock switch.
Let me give you the rationale here.
Okay.
Is that if we were to get rid of daylight savings time, the kids will be going to school in the dark.
That is, they tried it in the 70s, and that was the problem, right?
Yeah. Kids will be, right now, kids go to school, even with the days get as short as they can, it's still daylight. And personally, when I get up in the morning, that's kind of kicks off my biological clock. When the sun hasn't risen, it's hard for me to get up in the dark.
Yep.
And I'll sacrifice an hour later in the day in order to have sunshine in the morning when we get up. And I think it's better for the kids, personally. So I think adjusting the clocks, especially when they made that time period shorter for going to daylight savings time, they chopped off a month or more from that. So we don't do it for as long. But it's helpful up here in our northern latitudes to have that morning daylight. And I'm going to stand by that, Jack. I don't care what
that's a fair argument.
What the majority thinks.
Man, when that sun sets at like, when it gets dark at like 4 in the afternoon, it's depressing, especially after the Christmas lights come down and it's just January.
Yeah. I think it's depressing to get up in the dark. So, you know, there you go. That's the trade-off for us.
I guess.
I mentioned a couple other things going on around town. Schweitzer has gotten about 10 inches of snow the past few days. They've received 37 inches so far this season. They're hoping to open Thanksgiving weekend, I think on November 25th. And I will say, surprisingly enough, 49 degrees north. That's a ski resort that's in northeast Washington, north and east of Newport. They're opening this weekend. Yeah, that's pretty amazing. On November 11th, they're going to open for a few days.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would want to sacrifice my skis or snowboard to that thin coverage. And I know Schweitzer's also up there making snow right now. So I'd imagine they're headed towards a Thanksgiving opening if things pan out that way. You never know. I mean, next week we could get that warm weather that comes in and melts everything off.
Yeah, that, which would kind of be okay. It feels like winter has just arrived.
Yeah,
in full force, but I don't know.
Feels pretty set in.
Mm-hmm.
What about a couple of things going on around town before we get back into election stuff?
Sure. Here in town, this comes to us from Sandpoint Online. It's the Kinnickesu Land Trust, which you may have heard a interview yesterday with Phil Huff, with Katie Eglund Cox from the Kinnickesu Land Trust, here on KRFY, and listen to the podcast if you didn't. But the Kinnickesu Land Trust, the Pondere Peddlers, and Sandpoint Nordic Club's annual Get, parenthetically, Pine Street Woods Plowed Party, the Get Plowed Party, an annual fundraiser supporting the plowing and sanding of the Pine Street Woods, keeping it accessible all year long. A block party on Cedar Street in downtown Sandpoint. So it's not up at the Pine Street Woods. It's on Cedar Street here downtown. Food, drinks, music, and have a share in keeping the Pine Street Woods Road open this winter from, little crackle on the microphone there, from 6 to 9 p.m. Bring your pocket change for plowing and get the annual snowfall and guess the annual snowfall for a prize. Sponsored by Matchwood Brewing, Eichhardt's, McDuff's, and the Idaho Poor Authority.
Yeah, and that's tomorrow, Thursday, from 6 to 9 p.m. right down there on Cedar Street. And in fact, when I was driving in, I noticed they have a bunch of no parking signs up there to warn people.
Already blocked or blocking it off.
Yeah. And then another big seasonal event happening is the SARS Ski Swap, and that's the 11th and the 12th. That's Friday and Saturday at the Bonner County Fairgrounds. If you need any kind of gear for skiing or snowboarding, or if you just need cold weather gear, there's a ton of stuff there. Have you ever been to that, Jack?
I've stopped by. I think I might have bought a pair of cross country skis there,
yeah.
Or some kind of gear. Maybe it was poles, whatever. Yeah, it's a big deal. 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. Is that on both? It's on both days? Or no, just on Saturday.
Well, the drop-off is on Friday.
There we go.
Yeah. Okay. And then on Saturday is the ski swap. And people do get there early and get in line, the folks that are eager to get the best deals.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, those are the folks that really know what they want, because when you get in there, there's this like sea of skis and snowboards. And if you need to kind of know your gear when you get in there to understand what board you might want to get. But I will say, if you ever think about skiing or snowboarding, and it seems like it's beyond your budget, there are some super deals there.
Yeah.
You can outfit yourself very inexpensively with just a little bit older gear, but it's perfect. Usually it's perfectly good. And my viewpoint on the older gear is that, you know, something that's 5 years old, well, 5 years ago, it was state of the art probably. So, you're not that far behind the curve if you buy some slightly used equipment.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool event, too. Kind of fun just to go browse around and see everybody. Tonight, the 9th, meet the crew and have a brew at McDuff's Brew Pub. It's a event for the Scotchman Peaks, Friends of Scotchman Peaks Wilderness. You can, if you are already a friend, you can meet two new staff members, Graydon Quist, the Communications and Outreach Manager, and Joel Thompson, the Program Manager. That is at McDuff's, McDuff's Brew Pub, the one on 2nd Avenue. And what else?
Well, there's actually there's a ton of stuff going on. But one I definitely want to mention is on Thursday, the complete works of William Shakespeare, parenthetical abridged, are going to be on the stage at the Panda Theater at 7:30 p.m., and what they do is they do some really short little clips out of a bunch of his plays. Of course, if you tried to do all of Shakespeare's plays, and I got the complete works of Shakespeare when I was in college, and it's about a 4-inch thick, big tome. That'd be a fun one to go to, and you could actually work that where you went to the block party. It's 6 and enjoyed that for an hour and a half. Then at 7:30, go over and catch this great play that's going to be live on the stage.
It sounds pretty cool. I wonder what that's going to be like. It mentions comedy, improvisation, and audience interaction and or participation, as well as the Shakespeare that we all know and love. Yeah. And you're right, you'd be there for a couple of days, I suppose,
if you tried to
do the whole thing.
Yeah, and that's sponsored by Family Health Center and presented by the Pondere Arts Council. POAC does great work around this town, bringing cultural events like that.
Yeah, and as you said, lots more going on around town, but we can save some for tomorrow's morning show, too.
Yeah. Hey,
tune in.
Yeah, and you can catch the details on all this stuff and see the whole list of events at our website, krfy.org, or go to sandpointonline.com, which provides those. And this is our show where we're talking about the results of yesterday's election. Once again, if you've tuned in, Just in the last few minutes, the biggest race locally here was for Idaho State Senate. And in that race, the write-in Steve Johnson, the independent write-in Steve Johnson, lost to the Republican Scott Herndon. It actually wasn't even close. Herndon received 59.12% of the combined vote versus Johnson's 40.87% of the vote. And then the other kind of hot thing I thought on the ballot was the ballot measure for City of Sandpoint residents, the tax for tourist lodging, and that did pass. It required a 60% majority. It received 64.7% versus 1141%. Or 35% opposed, so that passed with about 4% to spare there.
And then we can go through the whole state results if we want to in just a moment. I want to ask you, Chris, what can you tell us about that tourist lodging tax? What's going to change in Sandpoint?
Well, the tax has been in place for quite a few years, actually. It's a 7% tax, and this proposal was to raise it to 14%. Sounds like a lot, but it's actually a little lower than the national average for tourist taxes of that mm-hmm. nature. I think a lot of people voters were seeing that as a way that tourists could contribute to this infrastructure here in town that falls on the backs of local residents more than tourists. And they chip in. The money there is going to be used for roads and sidewalks and all kinds of infrastructure needs for the city. and it also as well extended the time period that the tax will be in place. It was going to expire. The 7% tax was going to expire in, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, but now it's extended through 2035. So that tax is something we won't have to argue about for another 12 years?
Yeah, and that applies to any overnight stay at a hotel, but also
Airbnb,
yeah, right?
Short-term lodging, yeah.
And it's also, so 2035, yeah, a dozen years out. Is that the tax that the city of Sandpoint could only pass if its population was below a certain number?
Yeah, it has
number?
To.
So probably won't. If I recall correctly, it was 10,000. So very well.
Yeah. And our population, of course, is zooming up.
Right.
The last, the 2020 census, they had us at about 8,700, I think, or 8,800. With the additional people that are moving here, we're not too far off before we pass that 10,000 threshold to be able to do a local option tax like this.
Yeah. Let me go down the statewide results just for those who are interested, particularly kind of in the numbers. For United States Senator Mike Crapo handily defeated his nearest challenger, David Roth. Crapo, the Republican, received 60% of the vote, 346,000 votes to Roth's 167,000 votes. The Scott O. Cleveland, the independent, coming in with 8% of the vote, 50,000 votes for Scott O. Cleveland, who I'm not sure what that campaign was about, but 50,000, not a terrible showing for independent candidate for senator. The District 1 representatives, Ross Fulcher, the Republican, sailed to victory with 70% of the vote to Kaylee Peterson's 26% of the vote to about 211,000 votes to 80,000 votes. Mike Simpson, the Republican for District 2 with 63% of the vote, beat Wendy Norman with 36.48% of the vote. For governor, Brad Little was reelected with 60% of the vote, 348,000 votes to Stephen Heights, 118,000 votes statewide. But also showing was Ammon Bundy, 16% of the vote, not trailing too far behind the Democrat, came in with Mr. Bundy. kind of an interesting race there that we might circle back on to discuss. But for Lieutenant Governor Scott Bedke, the Republican beat Terry Pickens Manweiler, the Democrat, about 63% to 30%. For Secretary of State, Phil McGrane, the Republican, beat Sean Keenan, the Democrat, about 72% to 27%. For State Controller, Brandon D. Wolf, the Republican, with 69% of the vote, defeated Diana David with 27% of the vote. State Treasurer, Julie A. Ellsworth, the Republican, beat Deborah Silver, the Democrat, with 70% of the vote. Raul Labrador did become our next Attorney General. The Republican former Congressman Raul Labrador beat Democrat Tom Arcouche, 62% of the vote to 37% of the vote. For Superintendent of Public Instruction, Debbie Critchfield, the Republican, defeated Terry Gilbert, the Democrat, 69% of the vote to 30% of the vote. Then we come down to our other our non-statewide votes, where I'll just mention something that always interests me is how in unopposed races with the names appearing on the same ballot will end up with different totals. Mark Souder had 18,434 votes here in Legislative District 1, Seat A. The incumbent, Sage Dixon, had 17,501 votes. So nearly 1,000 votes less, although they're both running unopposed for different seats in the same legislative district. Just a note that I always find interesting to see how things kind of come up. Yeah, they're both Republicans. They're both...
That means that some folks that voted for Souder didn't vote for Dixon.
Yeah.
That's indicative. And in the Herndon race, of course, he received 13,064. But in that race, as we mentioned earlier, Steve Johnson, the independent write-in, received 9,031. So a total of votes cast is actually more like a little over 22,000.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of votes that didn't get cast for Republican candidates that were unopposed, and I'd assume that would be probably independents or Democrats who just wouldn't mark a Republican candidate even when he's unopposed.
Yeah. There's also, if I can find it here, the county commissioner's race, which of course was pretty well settled at the primary. but again, just to kind of mention the names of our next county commissioners. Where are we here?
I have it in front of me. Yeah. So yeah. Asia Williams received 15,046 votes. That's for the second district. In the third district, Luke Ahmed received 16,217 votes. So there again, there's about 800 vote difference between those two. The district court clerk, county clerk Mike Rosedale, received 16,096 votes. For county treasurer, Clarissa Coster received 16,162. For county assessor, Grant Dorman received 15,925. And for county coroner, Robert Beers received 16,410. Also, we should mention that there was a ballot question as a nonpartisan magistrate judge retention question that was on the ballot. Should Magistrate Lori Muhlenberg be retained, and the yes votes there were 80%, 81% almost in favor. The no votes were 19% opposed to Lori. there was an interesting thing that hardly got talked about. There was an Idaho advisory question, and it was basically saying, do you approve of the way we're spending money as proposed by the governor, and a bunch of other language in there. I don't have it in front of me. It's just an advisory question. It's non-binding, but it received, in our county, a 67, almost 68% approved it, 32% disapproved it. And that, I think that's similar to what happened statewide on that advisory question. Again, non-binding, it's something that the legislature uses to advise them on whether they should change course in the way they intend to spend that this big budget surplus that we have in Idaho. But no change probably is likely on that, considering that the advisory question kind of confirmed that.
And it was, I think it was put on the ballot. Yeah, it was. It was put on the ballot. The advisory question was put on the ballot by the legislature when they passed their kind of the relative act in the summer regarding what to do with that surplus, and particularly to greatly increase the spending on education in the state, which was seen by some as a response to the campaign by Reclaim Idaho to put a what would have been a different ballot measure on this November ballot. That measure was withdrawn.
To fund education.
Yeah, to fund education. The numbers were very similar between what the advisory question mentions, which is as regards the act passed this summer to increase education spending, and what the Reclaim Idaho was proposing on in their Proposition 1. I think those the legislature largely says, oh no, that the Proposition 1 had nothing to do with it, and Reclaim Idaho, of course, says, no, it had a great deal to do with it.
it was probably an impetus there. Statewide, so locally, 67% approved that advisory question. Statewide, I just looked this up, 79, almost 80% approved it. So statewide, the sentiment was stronger to support that advisory question than it was here locally. Again, we'll mention also that statewide, the Idaho Constitutional Amendment passed 51.72% of the vote versus 48.28% of the vote. Now, that's with 97.7% of the, let's see, if that current as of this moment, 97.7% of counties reporting. So there are still some votes out there. That is close enough that it could possibly change, but it's very unlikely at this point. It'd have to make up a 18,000 vote difference between the yes and the no on that. And that is one where in Bonner County, the Bonner County voters were more in favor of that because here there were 57% in approval of it. So it locally, 57% in Bonner County approved the constitutional amendment, and the no's were 42.8%. So we trended more in favor of that particular constitutional amendment.
Implications of that, should it should the total be finally that the Constitution will be amended?
Yes. I think it only took a simple majority to do that, which is kind of funny because it's a constitutional amendment. You think it would take a super majority, but I'm pretty sure that was just a simple majority.
So what does that mean for going forward?
Well, that one came out of really unhappiness by a lot of the legislators with the governor. They wanted, during the COVID lockdown, basically, they didn't like the way he was dealing with the lockdown. All of the measures that the state was taking with COVID, particularly mask mandates, I'd say was a trigger there. They began to push to get a legislative session so they could override some of the stuff he was doing. The governor is the one that can call legislature into session as it currently stands and has since our constitution was put together. And he refused to call a special session. So that was the genesis of getting this on the ballot. It's kind of interesting that Utah had a similar situation, and they passed an amendment like this where the legislature can call themselves into session a couple of years ago. And I think I read that they have called themselves into session 8 times.
Yeah.
In the course of a couple of years. Which, you know, we have a once a year legislature. Every time the legislature gets called into session, it costs about taxpayers about $200,000 to pay all the travel and the per diems that are involved to get legislators down there. So if our legislature starts calling themselves into session more often instead of dealing with the affairs of state during their annual session, it's going to end up costing us more. The trade off there is that, you know, they will have the ability to step in and override the governor on certain matters by calling themselves into session. It's a kind of a balance of powers between the legislative and executive branch question.
Yeah.
And I will say it's going to take a supermajority. 60% of legislators have to approve of calling themselves into special session. So they will have a little higher bar to clear to do that.
Yeah. It's not unusual for this to be the state. In other states in the union, that the legislature can call itself into session. I think we were in the minority being that the governor was the one who had to call a special session. This isn't some radical move in that sense, but
there are a number of the larger states that they stay in session the whole year, basically.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and our legislature by design was to be a legislature made up of citizens who have jobs outside of the legislature. Obviously if we had a full year legislature, they couldn't have other sorts of jobs.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a change, and maybe it comes with just more people in the state as well. I don't know. Our care state's the fastest growing state in the country, has been the last few years. percentage.
Yeah. The other statewide ballot measure, the advisory question, I did want to just mention that it was strangely worded, or at least to me, it didn't seem to be an unbiased wording of the question.
Not at all.
If you saw that, which ordinarily, if it's a yes or no, sometimes the advisory question is separate. But if it was an actual ballot measure with force of law, you probably would have seen it. An argument for and an argument against on the ballot, which I think that is something that happens in this state.
It's kind of looking in the rearview mirror, but I'll read the language of that advisory question. Do you approve or disapprove of the state of Idaho using the record budget surplus to refund $500 million back to hardworking Idaho taxpayers, cut ongoing income taxes by more than $150 million, and put more money in our classrooms by increasing education and student funding by a record $410 million? Your approval of this effort would combat historic inflation by returning money to the taxpayers, creating a simple flat tax, and make the single largest investment in public education in Idaho history. So sounds like a bit of advocacy there. Not neutrally worded.
The inclusion of the inflation argument, which is funny too. Or to put more, you give a whole bunch of people more money, expecting that that's going to, decrease inflation, is not really any kind of orthodox economic thought, but whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. That kind of is the opposite. Usually, if there's more money out there, it tends to make inflation worse. Mm-hmm. But the interesting part here is they are talking about creating a flat tax for income tax, and rather than a graduated tax, which is progressive. Mm-hmm. And if you make a lot of money, you pay a little higher percentage in tax. Mm-hmm. So this will change the tax structure if they follow through on that particular part of this.
Yeah. We could dive into the details of that, because they then change the minimum as well, maybe, or what you're allowed to the income on which you are not taxed at all is,
yeah, I think that goes up a little bit,
yeah.
In the proposal that's on the table that right. has not been approved. Mm-hmm. The governor did approve, the governor and the legislature in the special session they had earlier this year did approve the $410 million for education. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure about the flat tax. I don't think that was part of what was already approved. I think that comes up for consideration in this coming session. I might be wrong about that.
I would like to come back and talk more about the Scott Herndon, Steve Johnson race, but perhaps we should take a short musical break.
Yeah,
here.
Let's do that.
Okay.
Catch our breath,
Jack. Yeah, okay. You are listening to The Morning Show here on 88.5 KRFY. I'm Jack Peterson, Chris Bessler on the other microphone here. And let's hear a little local music. This is Doug Bond and Dennis Coates with their take on, I think it's Dennis's song, Election Year. Doug Bond and Dennis Coates with Election Year. You're listening to The Morning Show on 88.5 KRFY, talking about our local election results and the statewide results as well. You are tuned in the day after the election. Today is November the 9th, Wednesday, and we went to the polls yesterday. You know what I'd like to look up here, Chris, is how the results of this election compared to the last midterm election that we had, which I don't have in front of me, but I might pull that up.
Or if you can find it.
Yeah. If I can find it, because I wonder, I mean, one thing of note is that if you don't count the write-in campaign, we had no contested local races at all.
Exactly.
And, yeah. You know, and a write-in campaign hardly, I mean, ordinarily doesn't even count as a contested race.
Down in the single digits.
Yeah.
So, the supporters of Steve Johnson can take solace in the fact that he certainly outperformed what a write-in candidate usually gets by getting 40% of the vote. But again, a write-in candidacy is really tough to pull off.
So, some interesting things. I don't think it was widely expected that Steve Johnson would win this race. Were you surprised at how close it was in Bonner County? Or, how well he did perform, considering he was a write-in campaign, or were you expecting something like this?
I could not read that. Well, yeah. I mean, the realistic part of me was, it's write-in. He's not going to – he has a pretty big hill to climb. But there were so many signs out there and so many letters and so many much energy on the part of the Johnson supporters that it seemed like maybe something unusual was going to happen.
Yeah.
I couldn't even have made a guess other than to stick to the formula, which is writing candidates almost never win.
Yeah. Do you, the write-in part hurt him? He also was running as an independent, didn't have a Democratic tag next to his name or Libertarian or anything else. Do you think that was a mark in his favor? I mean, it seemed like he got more votes than a Democrat ordinarily would, even as a write-in campaign, still outperformed the normal Democratic turnout in a countywide election, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. at putting a D behind your name in Bonner County, where we're, you know, so heavily Republican, definitely gets a lot of Republican voters who might be more independent-minded, but they just can't bring themselves to vote for a Democrat because of the philosophical divide there. I think if his name had been on the ballot as an independent, it might have been a very close race.
That's kind of what I was thinking as well.
Because the voters that aren't necessarily paying attention, that may not be happy with a Republican candidate, would have had an opportunity to see another name there and vote for it kind of reflexively, as long as it wasn't a Democrat.
Right.
So I'd like to think voters are independent-minded enough that they don't just go by party. I mean, myself, when I vote, I go with the candidate every time rather than the party. And I'm not beholden to either of the parties, although I'm not declared as an independent personally. But I think there's still among a lot of our people here that sort of independent streak. So who knows? If he had been on the ballot, maybe he would have come closer to knocking off Herndon.
Yeah. Just as a note here, by percentage, the write-in campaign for Steve Johnson actually beat the write-in campaign for Shelby Ronstadt Ronstadt got about, off the top of my head here, looks like he got 30, in the high 30s percentage of the vote in the Democratic primary for governor, just locally here in Bonner County. Whereas no Republicans are voting at all, and Ronstadt is a well-known name, you know, I mean, if he's going to perform well anywhere, he's going to perform well in Bonner County. Still, the totals for Steve Johnson, the write-in campaign, were higher by percentage than they were for Shelby Ronstadt. Just interesting. Yeah. A write-in campaign is really hard.
Yeah, you know, it is. I mean, and Shelby fared much worse statewide as well. Mm-hmm. That was in the primary.
Right, yeah, in the primary.
And he was facing a candidate there who wasn't even hardly the Democratic candidate, who wasn't even hardly campaigning, Stephen Haidt.
I know.
And he lost by a huge, I don't have that number in front of me, but lost by a wide margin statewide in that primary.
Right, yeah. Statewide, Brad Little, I think, ended up with 60% of the vote, and Eamon Bundy ended up with almost 10% of the vote, leaving.
You're talking about this election.
Yeah, this election. Yeah, sorry. Right. Yeah. Brad Little, the incumbent Republican governor, looks like he came in with 60.5% of the vote for Brad Little, 348,533 votes for Brad Little. Stephen Haidt, the Democrat, running with only 20% of the vote, 118,000 votes. Eamon Bundy with 97,000 votes statewide, which is a pretty good showing for an independent candidate. Did you hear, after the primary, what did you hear from the Haidt campaign? Anything? You're a newsman.
He did campaign somewhat. He's a retired educator, lives down in southern Idaho, outside of Boise. But he did not mount a very big campaign. He didn't have a very big campaign fund to work with. That's kind of, you know, kind of shows that Democrats statewide have a real kind of built-in disadvantage in funding and name recognition and kind of getting back in the game for these statewide offices.
Yeah.
One question you asked was how this midterm election may have compared to the 2018 midterm election. I just did a little calculation here. looking back at results, it looked like there was a bit over 18,000, about 18,200 votes cast in Bonner County in 2018. And doing the math for the Herndon-Johnson race, there were about 22,095 votes cast. So almost 4,000 more votes cast in this election. That probably reflects, for one, we do have a little larger population. But I think it also reflects that people were more engaged with this midterm general election than they were 4 years ago.
Well, I mean, I also wonder, there's just a lot of questions that may be unanswerable. You know, Johnson being the only candidate running a campaign against any of the Republicans, did he get, you know, did he therefore get a lot more energy that might have been diffused if you had a whole slate of Democrats running against the Republicans?
I don't know. Pure conjecture.
Yeah. Unanswerable, but it, you know, something that, I kind of wonder about, the statewide race for governor, again, with 60% for Brad Little, a really strong showing for Eamon Bundy. It seems to me not enough to put him anywhere near over the hump, but a close third place finish. I kind of wonder if there were Democrats switching over from Stephen Hite to vote for Brad Little in an effort to stave off the Eamon Bundy campaign.
I bet there was some of that.
Yeah,
that occurred. Yeah, to give Brad Little more validation over a more conservative candidate such as Eamon Bundy. So one race I was watching with some interest was the Idaho State Attorney General, in which Raul Labrador who is a former congressman, was opposed by Tom Arkush, the Democrat. And Raul won quite handily there, 62% of the vote statewide to Arkush's 38% of the vote. But I was watching that one because there were quite a number of prominent Republicans that were supporting Arkush, which is very unusual for Republicans, like former office holders like Jim Jones, and I'm pretty sure that former Governor Butch Otter also was supporting Arkush over Labrador, which kind of is indicative of this ideological split that you see in the Republican Party itself, but made little difference. Raul came in with a lower percentage that you see in some of these other statewide races, you know, where the Republicans were garnering 70% or more. That probably did win a few Republican votes for Arkush, but indicative of a big hill that Democrats have to climb in order to stage a viable campaign here in Idaho.
Yeah. Labrador is also seen as more conservative than the outgoing attorney general, I believe, and more conservative than Brad Little, the incumbent and returning governor, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, kind of I think that's right. And, you know, he's already indicated that he's willing to be more litigious on questions where Idaho legislature may pass a law that might not pass muster with the U.S. Constitution. He's more willing to take that to court, whereas our current attorney general has passed on some of those because why spend that money on something that's going to lose? And those court bills can be $1 million or more. He's indicated that he is more likely to fight that ideological battle. And we'll have to wait and see how it plays out with him.
Once again, the races to watch in Idaho were all more or less settled in May, it seems to me. The governor's race was sort of interesting just to see what kind of turnout you'd get for Eamon Bundy. And that's about that. We didn't have that much to look at statewide.
Yeah, in the primary, there were a number of Republican candidates. Ammon Bundy actually, he started out as Republican and then he switched independent.
Yeah.
Because he, that kept him on the general election ballot. Independents don't have a primary.
Yeah.
But Brad Little pretty well dominated the Republican primary. I can't remember. There were five or six different Republican candidates in that primary election. Yeah. But again, he won pretty handily here with 60.5% of the vote statewide. And Stephen Hite, the Democrat, 20% of the vote, and Ammon Bundy, about 17% of the vote. Nothing changed in the balance there.
Yeah. Well, we should, I suppose, pretty much call it a day here. What we end up with going into 2023 is Brad Little, the governor, continuing, conceived as sort of a moderate Republican, at least as far as the state of Idaho is concerned, something of a moderate. But with the other centers of power in the state shifting, I would say, further to the right than they have been in years past.
I think that's probably a pretty good observation there, Jack.
Yeah. the other one is, and then locally, the Steve Johnson campaign. The last thing to say about that is, I wonder what Scott Herndon, the Republican, is feeling right now. Of course, he's victorious, but does he consider that this would be? Does he take this as a message that some of his own views need to be moderated a little bit to put him more in line with the voters of the counties that he represents, or? Does he say a win's a win and they voted for me?
You know, Scott didn't. He turned down our invitation to come on the show with Steve Johnson, which it's too bad. You know, when candidates won't, debate or face off against their opponent so that voters can compare them side by side. But on the hand, strategically, It to do that gives a writing candidate who has a built-in disadvantage, just strategically, they rarely would an incumbent give a write-in that opportunity.
Yeah.
So he didn't do anything unusual there. He did come in and we had one-on-one interviews for the primary. He says he's going to listen to everybody. So I don't know. We'll see how he proves up for the folks here as we move forward. Mm-hmm. So,
and his write-in opponent, Steve Johnson, doesn't seem to show any indication that he plans to retire from seeking public office. It'll be interesting to see if he's on the ballot again in 2 years, and actually, I should say, on the ballot, not as a write-in campaign.
The interesting thing for me will be to see if Jim Woodward, the incumbent, the current incumbent for Senate, decides if he wants to reengage and run again against Herndon in 2 years. That will be the most interesting thing to watch because it was a pretty vitriolic campaign, at least on Herndon's part, in the primary in which he unseated Woodward, who had a lot of respect from, more moderate Republicans and a lot of independents and Democrats as well. But primaries are won by the party that shows up to vote, and the energized folks in our primaries here are the more conservative ones.
Yeah. Well, there you have it, Chris. I don't know that I have any more to, well, I'm sure I have lots more to say, but I don't know that the listeners of this radio station want to hear us go on anymore. I think we've given all the details that we can at this time. It looks like the results locally are pretty final. Stay tuned to our national news programs like Democracy Now! If you want to keep track of the national results, which won't be final in some cases for quite a while as they go to recounts and things like that. But I think we can say good morning and let's go on to Otto's Eclectic Mix, right?
Yeah.
Anything else in closing, Chris?
Did we mention the lieutenant governor race? Scott Lidke won.
Only in passing.
That was a race that was being watched with some interest as well. So it was a testy, very testy primary race there.
Yeah.
Okay. Jack, should we say adios to our listeners?
I guess we better.
Okay.
Hey, I'll be back tomorrow morning with Jim Healy and Debbie Love, by the way.
And next Wednesday, we'll be talking about the Camp Bay road vacation question. That's Wednesday at 8 a.m. And I'm not sure what we have happening on Tuesday.
I was just going to try and pull that up here. Let's see. If you'll give me 5 seconds, we have coming up on Tuesday. Oh, I don't know what's coming up next Tuesday. And I apologize to our Tuesday morning co-host.
It's Phil and Julie. They always have a good show.
Yeah, it's a fall hunting and fishing update with TJ Ross from the Idaho Fish and Game, it looks like. So right in the nick of time, you'll have your fall hunting and fishing update, unless, of course, the lake freezes over and it's winter time for good now, which it might be. Anyway, I'm going to close out with a song that was at number one on this date in 1985. Here's your hint, Chris.
This is KRFY 88.5 Ponderé.
It's a instrumental song. It is a theme song from a television show. Can you guess which?
No, sorry, not enough to go on there.
The theme from Miami Vice was at number one on the Billboard pop charts on this date in 1985, which I think might have been the last time that kind of thing was topped the charts, maybe ever, unless maybe the theme from Friends or something did later on. Anyway, here's the Miami Vice theme, and then stay tuned for Bird Note and Otto's Eclectic Mix all day long, right here on 88.5 KRFY.